two things. Report, it is the duty of parents to hand over their daughters to suitable persons just befitting their tradition in cleanliness, gentle behaviour, wealth, social position, etc. Daksha was repentant that on the request of Brahma, who was his father, he had handed over his daughter to a person who, according to his calculation, was nasty. He was so angry that he did not acknowledge that the request was from his father. Instead, he referred to Brahma as Paramesthi, the supreme teacher in the universe, because of his temperament of gross anger. He was not even prepared to accept Brahma as his father. In other words, he accused even Brahma of being less intelligent because he had advised Daksha to hand over his beautiful daughter to such a nasty fellow. In anger, one forgets everything, and thus Daksha, in anger, not only accused the great Lord Shiva, but criticized his own father, Lord Brahma, for his not very astute advice that Daksha hand over his daughter to Lord Shiva. So, you know, this mood of Daksha was addressed in verse 13. There also, you know, devotees have already spoken on that subject matter about, you know, Daksha having to hand over his daughter to someone he didn't think very fit. So I'm not going to try and speak more than what other devotees have already said on this matter. So I'm going to move to the next verse.
Matraurvacha vinindhyayvam sagirisham apratipam navastitam dakshotapa upasprisha kura shaptam prachakrame.
The sage Maitreya continued, thus Daksha, seeing Lord Shiva sitting as if against him, washed his hands and mouth and cursed him in the following words.
I am tu deva yajana indra pendra dvibhava sahabham nalabhattam devediva ganadamaha.
Translation. The demigods are eligible to share the oblations of sacrifice, but Lord Shiva, who is the lowest of all the demigods, should not have a share.
Report by Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
Because of this curse, Shiva was deprived of his share in the oblations of Vedic sacrifices. It was due to the curse of Daksha. Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti comments in this connection that Lord Shiva was saved from the calamity of taking part with other demigods who were all materialistic. Lord Shiva is the greatest devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and it is not fitting for him to eat or sit with materialistic persons like the demigods. Thus the curse of Daksha was indirectly a blessing, for Shiva would not have to eat or sit with other demigods who were too materialistic. There is a practical example set for us by Gaura Kishore Das Babaji Maharaj, who used to sit on the side of a latrine to chant Hare Krishna. Many materialistic persons used to come and bother him and disturb his daily routine of chanting. So to avoid their company, he used to sit by the side of a latrine where materialistic persons would not go because of the filth and the obnoxious smell. However, Gaura Kishore Das Babaji Maharaj was so great that he was accepted as the spiritual master of such a great personality as His Divine Grace Om Vishnupad Sri Srimad Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Goswami Maharaj. The conclusion is that Lord Shiva behaved in his own way to avoid materialistic persons who might disturb him in his prosecution of devotional service. So a very, you know, very interesting. Here we have an interesting situation where a devotee acts in a way which is not the general course of how devotees are acting. The general course of how a devotee acts is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, verse number 9. Majjita madgita panda bodhiyanta parasparam kathiyantas cha mam nicham tushanti cha ramanti cha. The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me, their lives are fully devoted to my service, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. So there in the Bhagavad Gita we see that the normal standard activities of a devotee is that they're always seeking out each other's company. That is always the norm. And they actually derive great bliss and satisfaction from spending time together and talking about Krishna. Talking about Krishna also means talking about his name, his qualities, his form, his pastimes, his paraphernalia. His paraphernalia also includes his devotees and their activities in the Sankirtan movement, the mission of the Lord, the mood of the Lord, the different pastimes of the Lord. So all these different things are the usual activities of a devotee, and they become very blissful doing that. Sometimes, as an exception, so bear that in mind, this is not the usual case, there's a disruption to the normal activities of a devotee, and we see that, you know, here it describes that it says the curse of Daksha was indirectly a blessing, for Shiva would not have to eat or sit with other demigods. Now, of course, the demigods are devotees, so, you know, in this case, there's a situation where, okay, another devotee should not have to sit with another devotee or eat with them who's misbehaving, you know, or too materialistic. So, you know, these are the exceptions. Because, you know, all devotees have, we all have some material, taints. So, you know, if we didn't associate with a devotee who didn't have some materialistic taint, there'd be very few people to associate with. But here, it has come to a significant degree where, you know, we see that Daksha, the materialistic attitude has come to quite an intense degree where, you know, he's so angry at Lord Shiva, it's almost difficult for them to properly associate. And so angry that, you know, Daksha is even, you know, critical of his own father, who is superior to him in every way. So you can see the level of anger. And Srila Prabhupada, to substantiate this, you know, he gives the example of Srila Gaura Kishore Das Babaji. Now, Gaura Kishore Das Babaji also was sort of, he behaved in a similar way to what Lord Shiva did, in that of his own accord he chose not to sit and hear and chant and, you know, take prasad, etc., in the association of people who had, you know, they were devotees to some degree or another, but their materialistic, conditioning was to the point where it was actually disruptive to the service of Gaurakishore Das Babaji. So there's a critical point there that sometimes generally we try to be tolerant and just act in a very humble way, but when it comes to a very significant disruption in the service, an important service of a devotee, then the devotee may have to consider that, although, devotional service is going on to some degree, but it's going on in such a way that the element of Maya is very disruptive as well. And, one of my favourite stories about Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji is, the pastime where he, because he was almost blind, practically completely blind, but still, by the grace of Krishna, he used to wander all about the Dham as he pleased, going to the different places. And, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, would sometimes say, how did you arrive here? Because he would also sometimes walk in the middle of the night, it's pitch black, and, cross treacherous rivers and all sorts of things. And according to Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, it appeared that Krishna was literally with him, taking him in all different places. But he was very much blind. So sometimes he would stay in a dharamshala, and people would offer, some foodstuffs which he would then cook, and he would offer to Krishna, and then take a little prasad, and then do his chanting and bhajan. So that was his service to Krishna, and you have to remember that for Gaurakishore Das Babaji, when he's offering his food to Krishna, Krishna's personally there eating it, and there's no doubt in his mind, and there's no doubt in Krishna's mind, Krishna's, literally sometimes in the guise, it appears that in some pastimes, it appears that in sometimes in the guise of a little boy, someone was taking Gaurakishore Das Babaji's hand and taking him to different places. So, that offering that boga to Krishna is, he took very seriously. This is, Krishna will come in such and such a time, I will give him some prasadam like that. Others may not see that, but he understood that. One day he went out to get the boga, and they used to hang from a basket with a rope, sort of on a wall type thing. And when he went out, he had his cane, he was reaching up to get the basket, and some of the devotees, they would see Gaurakishore and Babaji Maharaj come out, and they would, watch. And this lady, she yelled out, "Oh, Babaji Maharaj, stop, stop, and there's a snake. So there was he didn't see, but a snake was sort of crawling down the rope and sort of onto the basket. So what he did was he took his cane, and he, knocked at the wall, and the snake went down, and, it went away. So then, he went to get the food, and the lady was saying, they're all devotees, the people that were there. She was saying, "Babaji Maharaj, you go into your room, I will cook that, I will get the bog, I will cook that, and I'll bring it into you." So he said, no, I always, I cook that myself, I will do that, that's okay, Mataji. "Babaji Maharaj, there's a danger here, there's snakes, you go into your room, I will bring the boga in there, and then you can..." No, that's okay, Mataji, I will get the boga, I will make this offering." "Babaji Maharaj..." So then he got really angry. He got really angry, and he said, "Bhattaji," he used to say things like, "If you don't stop, I'll jump in the Ganges and commit suicide." He would actually sometimes he used to do that. They'd have to drag him out of the Ganges. He would become so angry. So anyway, you know, they all, when Maharaj was very angry like that, they all sort of went, she went away. But then Babaji Maharaj, he said, he was saying to the devotees there, that, did you see just what happened? Did you see what happened? And they're going, yes, the snake. No. Oh, the woman. No. He was saying, Maya Devi, in the guise of devotional service, was trying to prevent me from doing my service. And Maya Devi made this arrangement. In the guise of devotional service, she was trying to prevent me from doing my service. And there's no way that when, you know, he was not going to serve Krishna personally, you know, cook that and eat that prasad and do his usual service. So, you know, in that case, you see that there's a significant disruption to service. So usually devotees, actually the usual is that they're come together and they assist each other, the Sankirtan movement, to do their service. So this is an exception. You know, this is talking about exceptional circumstances. So Prabhupada is giving the example of Gaurakishore Das Babaji that, you know, devotees would come, they want the blessing to, you know, even to do devotional service and this and that, but sometimes, you know, their materialistic attitude and their lack of surrender and their lack of proper sincerity meant that they were really obstructing his service, that he just couldn't chant without disruption. He took his chanting so seriously. So, you know, sometimes, you know, we chant and there's many different things we may chant and talk and so many things at the same time. But Srila Gaurakishore Das Babaji, you know, if you're chanting, you're chanting. Krishna is there and you don't take your attention off him for a moment. Like that. You know, so, you know, so he, Prabhupada gives that example. Now, a similar thing, you know, happened with Srila Prabhupada in that, you know, his own god brothers, you know, who were, they sort of, they'd also, there was some materialistic trait, you know, that doing devotional service, you know, they were advanced persons, but somehow or another, you know, circumstances can bring out the worst in people, and you know, they actually began to fight amongst themselves for their own purposes. You know, who would be the leader, who would be the guru, who would have the control. Which was, and they sort of abandoned the real mission of their spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, to, you know, work cooperatively. Don't, you know, work for your own individual purposes. Work what? Cooperatively, spread Krishna consciousness in the, and also, you know, all over the world like that, because people are suffering. And we see that, you know, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the deliverer of the most fallen. He takes particular attention to, you know, doesn't matter how sinful they are, he doesn't see that. Oh, this person is suffering. Oh, that's their karma. They must deserve that. Are they getting what they deserve? He doesn't see it like that. He sees that these people are suffering. How fortunate. You know, perhaps I can, you know, deliver them from that suffering condition. And Lord Shiva has the same mentality as a Vaishnava, that he's been given, because he's such a great Vaishnava, he takes it upon himself to, which is also the mission he's been given. He's actually been officially, you know, given the task to give shelter to the most fallen and wretched persons in the universe. That's his official devotional service. So he's really only doing what he's been asked to do, assigned to do, empowered to do. So, you know, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had that mood. You know, let's go to the West and deliver people who are suffering like that. But Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers, you know, they lost that. They neglected that instruction. In neglecting that instruction, they neglected the real purpose of the Gaudiya Math, you know, that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had explained. We've had that also in ISKCON. You know, I hope devotees never go through that, but in previous years, back in the 80s, when, you know, some leaders in our society, big leaders who, you know, ruled over whole zones and big chunks of the world, as the absolute leader, really, you know, some of them fell down, and what happened was people become very angry at ISKCON and at Prabhupada. So, like what here, what Daksha is doing, you know, is you know, when there was some disturbances, you know, in ISKCON, you know, many people, many devotees fought amongst themselves in the thousands, and a very difficult time to live through. And you know, it was interesting because I had the experience where you're just trying to process what's going on. And while you're doing that, there's, you know, 20,000 people who hate you because you haven't taken the side, the devotees. And then there's another 20,000 devotees who hate you because you didn't take that side. And there's another 20,000 devotees who hate you because you're sitting in the middle. And really you're just thinking, you know, well, there's some terrible thing happened in ISKCON. And I'm trying to understand it, you know, and that's all you're doing. But you know, but in that process, you see that a lot of people, you know, even to this day, there are many during that time who become very disturbed at ISKCON and very disturbed at the Prabhupada, although, you know, he was innocent. But just the anger, you know, does that, like here. So, in this case, you know. You see here, this is sort of shown out. I read this Vyasa Puja homage by Srila Prabhupada. It sort of shows that he was in a similar predicament, a similar position. This is 1961, February 1961, on the Vyasa Puja day. It's the anniversary appearance of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. It was in Vrindavan, as it had been before. So this is from the Prabhupada Leela Rita, Volume 1, Chapter 10. In honour of their spiritual master, some of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's disciples had gathered, offered flowers before his picture and held congregational chanting in the temple. But Bhaktivedanta Swami thought that they should be doing much more than that. They should be planning and executing the worldwide preaching mission that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had desired. Instead, they were a gathering of independent individuals, each with his own small idea, each maintaining a small centre or living at the centre, but with no world programs, not even a program for India. Most of them had no plans or vision beyond their own bodily maintenance. This is what he's writing this because these are the statements of Srila Prabhupada by which Srila Sasrut Maharaj, you know, wrote this Leelamrita. This is what Srila Prabhupada was saying. So, you know, you can see some materialistic, you know, way. But these, we have to remember, these are advanced devotees, but somehow or another, circumstances have brought out the worst in them. Sometimes these things happen. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had asked for a governing body to conduct his movement, but there was no governing body and practically there was no movement. Some who had fought bitterly were again on speaking terms and feared that any sudden organisational attempts now might simply stir up old animosities. At least they could gather together and make an offering to their spiritual master. Amongst his godbrothers, Bhaktivedanta Swami was a junior sannyasi. Although a recognized writer and editor, he had no temple or followers. Yet he knew he was trying to follow Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. He saw himself helpless and alone against the vast forces of Maya. His godbrothers were not an army united against Maya's forces, but were more like apathetic monks growing old, holding on to religious principles and rituals devoid of life. How could they gather to worship their spiritual master without distressfully admitting their failure? And in the spirit of better late than never, try to rectify it. Since the custom on Vyasa Puja Day was for each disciple to write an offering glorifying his spiritual master and to share it within the assembly of godbrothers, Bhaktivedanta Swami wrote an offering more like an explosion than a eulogy, and humbly placed it before his godbrothers for their response. So he goes on. If the disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati could join and preach together, there was every chance that they could create a spiritual revolution within the sinful world. That had been the hope of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, and Bhaktivedanta Swami expressed that hope in his Vyasa Puja offering. As he read the poem, its truth exploding in the midst of the gathering of aging sannyasis, some approved and some were incensed. Their meeting, however, took no new direction. They did not sit down together as plan as he had pleaded. Swami Maharaj's poem was taken as another poetic expression or as an opinion. The godbrothers were inclined to let the old wounds heal with the passing of time. To go back over the whole thing again and reconstruct the mission as it had been before, when Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati had been present, and to attempt all those ambitious programs, how was it possible? They were getting old. Some did not want to leave the shelter of Vrindavan. They would worship Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati within the holy dham. If Bhaktivedanta Swami could do something more, let him go ahead and try. Bhaktivedanta Swami returned to Keshigat thoughtful. For many years, he had been unable to take a leading part in the mission because of family commitments. In 1935 in Bombay, his godbrothers had even asked him to be the president of the mat there, but Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati had said that it was not necessary that a Bhai Charan join them. He would come in his own way. Now, by the grace of his spiritual master, he was ready to fulfill the meaning of sannyas. So here we see even Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, who had predicted what his disciples would do. He wasn't in a hurry that Srila Prabhupada would be caught up in that fray. So the Krishna consciousness world he had described in his poem was not a utopia presented merely to incite his godbrothers. A dream is talk of the impossible. It was possible. But in any case, he had to write and print Krishna conscious books and preach abroad. It was what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati wanted. If his godbrothers would not do it jointly, then he would do it. So here we see that the general course of devotees is that they seek out the opportunities to sit and chant and eat together. In this circumstance, Srila Prabhupada could see that that wasn't possible. Because if he did that, it meant that it would be just present a significant obstacle or delay in his attempt. And of course, he was, at that stage, 1961, so, he was in his sort of mid-60s, mid to late 60s. you know, as he had previously been to see someone from one of the other mutts, and they also telling him to delay, just spend some time in India, work for my mutt, and you know, so many things. Had Srila Prabhupada done that, had he actually followed the guidance of his godbrothers, the movement wouldn't have happened, because he probably would have passed away in India without, you know, ever coming to the West. So in this case, sitting and just spending that time chanting and hearing was an obstruction to, you know, a very significant movement. So Srila Prabhupada, in a similar way, you know, sought to do differently. You know, he was sort of forced in it, almost like he appeared to be acting independently, but he was forced to go somewhere else. Now, another example that Srila Prabhupada gives is that one of Srila Prabhupada's disciples asked him that, because sometimes the devotees, you know, the Western devotees would try to go and see Jagannath in Jagannath Puri, and usually you get beaten with canes because, you know, they're Westerners. So he asked Srila Prabhupada that, Lord Jagannath's the Lord of the universe. You know, why is he not letting us in the temple? You know, why doesn't he make arrangement that, you know, why are we getting beaten? We can't get in there. Srila Prabhupada answered, he said, because that the devotees there, they have the habit of, you know, eating their Jagannath prasad with fish, which is very offensive. And Srila Prabhupada said, because of that, such offences, Jagannath is denying them from having the association of the ISKCON devotees. Mm. Because, you know, Srila Prabhupada, again, when Prabhupada went to Jagannath Puri, he'd planned it for a long time, and when he was young, he went to Jagannath Puri. And someone had mentioned to him, you go and stay with such and such a person, he's a nice devotee. So he actually went and stayed with that person. And the person served him up some, like, soup type thing. And Prabhupada was looking at it and said, what are these little lumps? I don't recognize that vegetable. And it was some sort of meat. You know? So Prabhupada was shocked. He, you know, this is a devotee that he's come to stay with, is serving meat to another devotee. So Srila Prabhupada left Jagannath Puri. He didn't, you know, so, you know, sometimes, you know, one can't even take, you know, sit and associate. It was just too disturbing to Srila Prabhupada to stay there, so he left. And so, you know, he mentioned that Lord Jagannath, he doesn't allow those devotees to associate with the ISKCON. They're being deprived, you know. And here we see in this Daksha Yagya, because of the demigods, because they're too materialistic, they're actually being deprived of Lord Shiva's association. That's the reality. And nor does, you know, Lord Shiva care to stay there as an obstruction, you know, to his service and his nice meditation. So. So when, you know, therefore, you know, when that hearing and chanting is going on nicely and the association is going on nicely, generally devotees get great strength from each other. You know, that is the usual course. So usually, you know, throughout your whole life, most of the time that's what devotees will be doing. You know, very rare, and hopefully not at all, you come across these circumstances. You know, they're an exception to the rule, where, you know, there is such a significant disturbance that it creates a great impediment to the propagation and the, you know, expansion or even maintaining Srila Prabhupada's movement nicely. And one has to consider then, you know, the circumstances. And so Srila Prabhupada, of course, he wanted to spread the Srimad Bhagavatam throughout the world. His spiritual master specifically asked him to write books. And amongst the books, especially Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, but Srimad Bhagavatam especially. So to understand the significance of Srila Prabhupada's mission, I'm going to read something here. About Srila Prabhupada's mission to spread Srimad Bhagavatam. So in 1962, Srila Prabhupada published the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, volume 1, in Delhi. And he's in the Radha Damodar temple at this stage. Sometimes going to Delhi. So it's described that in June the weather had become intolerably hot and one could not remain active through the afternoon. He was known in Vrindavan as a scholar and a sublime devotee, but he kept to himself as much as possible, especially in the summer of 1962, working on Srimad Bhagavatam. That was his real purpose in coming here, to prepare the books he could distribute to the people in the West. Although as yet he had no means for travelling, even as far as Japan, and no means for printing books, these were the goals for which he worked. He had not come to Vrindavan to die and return to Godhead. Rather, he had come because it was the ideal place to gain spiritual strength for his main life's work. The exact shape of his future mission, Bhaktivedanta Swami did not know, but he did know that he must prepare himself for preaching Srimad Bhagavatam to the English-speaking Western world. He must become a perfectly equipped instrument of his masters, and if they desired, they would send him. Now from Prabhupada Lila, Volume 1, Chapter 11. Writing was only half the battle. The other half was publishing. Both Bhaktivedanta Swami and his spiritual master wanted to see Srimad Bhagavatam printed in English and distributed widely. According to the teachings of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, the most modern methods of printing and distributing books should be used to spread Krishna consciousness. Although many books of Vaishnava wisdom had already been perfectly presented by Rupa Goswami, Sanatan Goswami and Jiva Goswami, the manuscripts now sat deteriorating in the Radha Damodar temple and other locations, and even the Gaudiya Math printings of the Goswami's works were not being widely distributed. One of Bhaktivedanta Swami's godbrothers asked him why he was spending so much time and effort trying to make a new commentary on the Bhagavatam, since so many great acharyas had already commented upon it. But in Bhaktivedanta Swami's mind there was no question. His spiritual master had given him an order. Commercial publishers, however, were not interested in the 60-volume Bhagavatam series, and Bhaktivedanta Swami was not interested in anything less than a 60-volume parampara presentation of verses, synonyms and purports based on the commentaries of the previous acharyas. But to publish such books, he would have to raise private donations and publish at his own expense. Radha Damodar Temple may have been the best place for writing Srimad Bhagavatam, but not for printing and publishing it. For that, he would have to go to Delhi. When the printing and binding were completed, there were 1,100 copies. Bhaktivedanta Swami would receive 100 copies, and the printer would keep the balance. From the sale of the 100 copies, Bhaktivedanta Swami would continue to pay off his debt to the printer and binder. Then he would receive another supply of books. So, you know, he's going out and distributing his own books, making sure he gets a good donation. This would continue until he had finished paying his debt. His plan was then to publish a second volume from the profits of the first and a third volume from the profits of the second. Bhaktivedanta Swami went to the major libraries, universities and schools in Delhi, where the librarians found him calm and quiet, noble, polite, scholarly, with a specific glow in him. Travelling on foot, he visited school administration offices throughout Delhi and placed copies in more than 40 schools in the Delhi area. The Ministry of Education, which had previously denied him assistance, placed an order for 50 copies for selected university and institutional libraries throughout India. The US Embassy purchased 18 copies to be distributed in America through the Library of Congress. His spiritual master, the previous spiritual masters, and the Vedic scriptures all assured him that he was right. If a person got a copy of the Bhagavatam and read even one page, he might decide to take part in Lord Chaitanya's movement. If a person seriously read the book, he would be convinced about spiritual life. The more this book could be distributed, the more the people could understand Krishna consciousness. And if they understand Krishna consciousness, they would become liberated from all problems. Book selling was real preaching. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati had wanted it, even at the neglect of constructing temples or making followers. Who could preach as well as Srimad Bhagavatam? Certainly whoever spent 16 rupees for a book would also take the time to at least look at it. So these books, they have the full potency of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, all the Acharyas, Krishna, Srila Prabhupada. That's how I became a devotee. And, you know, I read my first Prabhupada book when I was so intoxicated I could barely stand. And I still understood that that was what I was looking for. It was so powerful. No, seriously. I picked it up at a party. I pulled it out of the shelf accidentally. And, you know, I looked at it and I thought, this is what I'm looking for. And, you know, I was trying to keep my eyes in focus because I was so intoxicated. I won't tell you all the different things I'd had that night. No, let's not go there. And I said, the lady who had, she was, you know, an ex-partner. I said, it was a Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada's full bag. I said to her, can I have this bag? Can I have this book? Can I take it? Can I keep it? And it was an ex-partner. We'd broken up. She said, you give me your diary and I'll give you that Bhagavad Gita, that book. So I just immediately gave her the diary. Yeah, you have that. There's just nonsense in there. I'll take the Gita. 1978. Early 1978. And then I read that Gita, and then what happened was, after reading the Gita, I actually quit my job so I'd have more time to read the Gita. It wasn't unusual. I didn't work very much anymore. Hippies don't work. Anyway, and I thought to myself, I'd like to get another book by Prabhupada. And I remember that my brother had one time brought home this little pink soft copy book. And I said to him, what's that book? He said, oh, it's a book about yoga, you wouldn't be interested. And he hid it. I never ever saw it. So that was probably, you know, a year before or something. And then after reading, I thought to myself, I wonder if that book was one of Prabhupada's books. I just had a feeling about it. And I searched, because we used to stay in the same room, in double bunks, even as teenagers. And as a baby, he used to sleep in the top drawer and I used to sleep in the bottom drawer. Chest of drawers. And, so not much changed as we got to teenagers. But anyway, I searched the room. I couldn't find it anywhere. And I thought, you know, I know my brother, he's a bit of a scholar, he doesn't throw books out. I looked under the bed, right under the bed, right in the back corner, the shoes and, you know, things that... There in that box there, I pulled out this book and I crawled out from under the bed and I flipped over the back of it and there's a picture of Prabhupada on the back. Nectar of Devotion. And I thought, oh, great, another book by Prabhupada. And what I used to do is I used to get a bag of dry muesli and some water and a tent, and I'd go up to Arthur's Seat in the forest up there, and I'd stay there and I'd just read like that, and I'd read for weeks like that. And then when I finished that book, it was after that that I met a devotee. But by reading, and I didn't even know that there was a movement, but by reading the books, I was thinking to myself, you know, it always talks about associating with devotees. Wouldn't it be nice if it was actually, you know, devotees and a movement that you could actually associate with? I really had no idea. And when I saw the devotees, it was a real, you know, pleasant surprise. But, you know, I always remember the potency of Srila Prabhupada's books. You know, that they just, you felt Krishna's presence and they just changed your life, just in a big way. And, you know, I know when I met Ramaswamy, when I came to the temple the first time, he said, you know, have you read some of our books? And I said, yeah, I've read the Bhagavad Gita and the Nectar of Devotion. And he said, did you understand it? I said, yes. You know, because I'm thinking, well, I'm here at the temple. So I've obviously understood something. But he sort of had a look on his face as if, sure. You know. And after some years as a devotee, I realized that he was correct. I really had very little understanding. I had enough to understand that, you know, I accepted, okay, Krishna says he's God. Well, I'm not going to argue because I don't know any other God. And I'm his servant, and I'm certainly suffering in the material world, so I'm not going to argue with that. So I understood that much. But when I look back, you know, I remember that one of the things that really stands out is my lack of understanding. So I had some gut understanding, but it was that when I was working as a landscape gardener, you know, I was trying, so I got a job again, and I was trying to offer everything to Krishna. And so we used to, you know, rake up the, you know, after you put in a lawn sort of thing, and, you know, there's just all dirt, and you rake up all the bits of cement from the builders and pebbles and, you know, rubbish and things, you put it in the wheelbarrow, and you're usually supposed to put it in the rubbish, but in those days, they probably still do it here, I think, you know, they just tip it over in the next block, you know. So anyway, as I was tipping the wheelbarrow out, I was thinking, here's an offering for you, Krishna. I'm offering everything. You've got to offer everything to Krishna. It says that in the Gita. See? So it was only after a couple of years, one day it dawned me, when I'd been a devotee for a couple of years, it dawned on me. I was thinking about that. And I remember whenever I picked up my pay to go out on a Friday, Saturday night, I never thought, oh, this is for you. That was always for me. So, you know, I understood that, you know, I had some, you know, had some sense, but really until you associate with devotees. Prabhupada says when you associate with devotees, you get a feel for devotional service like that. So it's very important. Otherwise, you know, hearing and chanting in the association of devotees. But, the time, I have no idea what that says. I've got two pairs of glasses. New glasses, I'm getting used to. Yes, we'll start finishing up in a minute. So, but here, you know, this is Prabhupada's mood. That the Bhagavatam is saying that, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati is saying that, the Acharyas have written books, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You know, you take Krishna consciousness and it will, you know, save people from the suffering of Kali Yuga. And Bhaktisiddhanta especially, that was his contribution, you know, book distribution, the Brihat Madanga, you do that. And very, very important service that should never be disrupted. So, you know, Srila Prabhupada, who, you know, was perfect in his etiquette, Vaishnava etiquette, but even in Vrindavan, because of the mission, he didn't associate a lot. he kept to himself. Because mostly he wanted to get that service done. And also, because of the disturbances there with, you know, the Gaudiya Math, he tried to sort of associate, but he could see that that would not help that mission. See? So there are exceptions to the rules, you know, that sometimes because service has to be done, or sometimes there's a significant service. But the general rule is that devotees take every opportunity, you know, to hear and chant amongst themselves. And at the same time, you know, there's the principle of making sure that the service that needs to get done, gets done. See? Just like in the kitchen. You know, when I work in the kitchen, I very rarely talk. Andy really knows I cook, but I don't advertise it too much. But what's that? But I don't talk, you know, when especially making gulab jamuns, because you know you take your attention off for 20 seconds and you've got, you know, funny that. So I used to just absolutely concentrate. So people might think I'm being a bit antisocial, but the thing is, you've got to turn out some nice gulab jamuns, you know, not have a good conversation. So, you know, there are some times where you can, you know, you have a little chat amongst the devotees while you're doing your service, but there's some times where you just can't. Sometimes, you know, when I get to the temple also, I've got to set up, there's some people coming for a ceremony, so I really don't talk to people because I'm, you know, flat out for time. So in this way, we follow the usual process of always associating at every opportunity with devotees, hearing and chanting nicely. And at the same time, we keep the principle of making sure the service that we're doing gets done properly, that, you know, the hearing and chanting is not a disruption to that or a delay to it. And sometimes, you know, within our movement and other movements, and, you know, there is some, you know, occasional hiccups with, you know, the usual association devotees may be interrupted. And but in those circumstances, as we see from Lord Shiva and from Srila Prabhupada, the main thing is that no matter what happens, we keep pushing on with our services, what Srila Prabhupada did, and gradually that will rectify everything. So I'll leave it there if anyone has any comments or questions. So the question is, if a person gives us karma, does that person who gives us karma get the reaction? So what do you mean by they give us karma? Can you give me an example of what you mean?
If somebody does bad things,
they do some bad things?
He gets the reaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only person who's giving karma is Krishna. Krishna is the demigods are not giving karma. There's no one in this world giving karma. Krishna is the only person who actually gives people karma. But when Krishna gives karma, it's because not that what happens is that Krishna organizes that a person does something. So a person wants to do something. And because that person is doing something, then that person is responsible for the good and bad effects of what they do. So Krishna gives them the good and bad effects. Because they want to do it, Krishna gives them the effects of what they do. But only Krishna can give that. And only Krishna can take away those good or bad effects, that karma. Only Krishna can give karma, and only Krishna can take it away. No one else, not any demigods, not ordinary persons. Devotees can't give someone else karma. Only Krishna is giving karma. And if we're just doing our service nicely, then we're protected. Then Krishna is also not giving us karma. He's protecting us from all sorts of, you know, reactions, material reactions. Does that explain that? Yeah. Nice question. Thank you. Any other questions?